It's my pleasure this evening to welcome you on behalf of the Cambridge University Baha'i Society to this talk entitled, Is the Question of God a Matter of Truth? And with us here tonight, we have Mr. Ismail Velasco, who is a professional consultant in the field of urban regeneration, social cohesion, and international development, with field experience in some 20 countries and publications in this area. And in his hobby, he's an independent scholar who's published in peer-reviewed academic journals in the fields of religion, literature, and history. And he's here to talk to us tonight to try and answer the question, how is it possible that a fellow human being could be the voice of divine, be the manifestation of God? And how is it that when we look at all the claims made by various peoples around the world, both the nefarious and the well-meaning, to lead mankind to the shores of peace, how is it when so many have failed that we should consider another limited, seemingly imperfect human being to be rather that perfect and infallible manifestation of God? So, Mr. Ismail Velasco, I welcome you to Cambridge, and I give you the floor.
Thank you. I'll take it from afterwards. It's great to be here, and they say that hunger makes food taste nicer, and by the time I was so hungry to get here that I know I'm going to enjoy this all the more, and I'm really grateful for your patience that you have been here. Originally, this talk came out of a question that I was invited to answer, which was, why do we need to believe in God, and why do we need religion? And they are two very different questions. I'll get back to this. But to me, the very question kind of misses the very nature of belief. We don't believe because we find it useful or necessary. It's one of it's a subject of endless fascination to me, how so many of our most crucial subjective experiences are within our influence, but beyond our control. So beauty, for example, is one of them. We can influence our interaction with it, but we can't really control whether we find something beautiful or not. If something beautiful happens to stand before us, we just feel it and it overwhelms us and we say, this is beautiful, our heart is attracted, well before any control of ours. Understanding is another one. We can influence the process of understanding. We can sort of work towards it more or less, but we can't control whether we understand or not. Once we've understood, it just happens. And it's something that's there. I think belief, it partakes of the same kind of characteristic. When we encounter something, we can influence to some extent our interaction with reality, with what we consider to be true or not, the parameters by which we search it, but our conviction is something that exceeds to some extent our control. So if we become convinced that my daughter, who is here until not so long ago, sort of believed in Santa Claus, and she didn't have much control over that, and it was a logical belief which was confirmed by empirical experience until her grandmother kind of gave the game away, and then she had no control of whether she believed in it or not. Truth has that way about it. And similarly, I think this whole question of God, why do we need to believe in God or not, it's in a sense a non sequitur. We either do or we don't. But if we do, it's not because we need to. And if we don't, it's not because we don't need to, as it were. So this question between the true and the useful is one that is a perennial one in intellectual history. Opinions, ideas were considered to be true and or useful. And they weren't always the same. Sometimes beliefs can be very useful, which are not true. And sometimes believes, for instance, to give an example, we now know that the whole of Newtonian physics was based on premises which are no longer sustained to some extent by sort of later research. Now, nevertheless, a lot of those schemes, a lot of those models proved extremely useful and remain so because we still haven't found a way of harmonizing sort of relativity and quantum mechanics, and we're looking for some way of bridging the two. So there are elements where what is true, apparently, or what we understand, is not necessarily true but can be useful. Likewise, there are things which are true which may not be very useful, at least immediately. There are bits of knowledge that we all carry that are not particularly useful, even though they are true. It probably isn't at all useful for you to know that three junctions of the M25 were blocked on my way here. I know it, and it's really a very useless piece of knowledge to me. It really didn't help me one bit to know that it was true. So this distinction between the true and the useful brings us back to this nature of belief. And in a sense, the two questions of, why do we need to believe in God, what do we need to religion, are in some ways the true and the useful, because we can control whether we join or not a religion, whether we accept or not sort of a religious identity, but we cannot control whether we consider a given claim true or not. We can control whether we investigate it or not. We can control whether we make room for the possibility of something that goes against what we've always believed or accepted, or vice versa. But once we confront it, we don't have that control over that persuasion, both ways, which is why I think the entire notion of a religious debate seems to me so pointless. Because in a sense, it is not about forcing somebody else to believe one thing or another. It is about all of us being in front of this wide thing called reality. And reality is much bigger than sort of God or not God. It confronts us in every moment of our existence, in every aspect of our lives. So here we come then to the next step in this question, which is the notion of language. We seem to make sense of reality through language. Language is the thing that allows us to organize our experience of the world, to segment it, to clarify, to categorize it. And we develop theories, tools, labels, languages, concepts, constructs, all kind. I'm running out of synonyms and antonyms and related cognate concepts. But basically, we use language to approach reality and to process it. It's part of our makeup. It's distinct in many ways to the human. I think there is communication in other species, but it seems that we are the only ones who really use language to this extent as a means of processing not just interaction, but comprehension and understanding. So the question then becomes for me, what is the relationship between language and reality, between language and truth, between concepts and what is out there, as it were. And people have very different perspectives on this. The Baha'i perspective on this is that reality is ultimately ineffable, that ultimate reality, that sort of essence of reality, what is, what truly is, does not fit in language. It goes beyond language. This is something that, again, is a long-running theme in sort of the philosophy of ideas and epistemology. So the distinction between attributes and essence, for example, or between phenomenon and noumenon, this idea that somehow we have access to manifestations of reality, but somehow the essence either remains unapprehensible, and if apprehensible, it becomes ineffable. What does ineffable mean? Ineffable means that it goes beyond language, beyond description. Now, I think to bring this back to to us, as it were, as individuals, to make it graspable. I can venture a guess, and this might be my more poetic side streaming out, but I hope that it will resonate even with sort of more dry rationalists amongst you. When you have a very profound subjective experience of most things, it might be of love, it might be of beauty, you might come across this extraordinary landscape, it might be of pain and sorrow, it might be the loss of a dear person, it might be of fright, of terror, a whole range of experiences. Has anyone felt that that experience transcends words? Doesn't mean you cannot talk about it. You can talk about it, but somehow you might feel that after all the words, there is something more in that experience, something that just you cannot describe. So I can say this incredible landscape I saw at this moment of my life that was so crucial, was so beautiful, it was stunning, and I'm using all these words that are really trying to evoke rather than describe, to evoke rather than encapsulate, somehow to trigger that sensation, that feeling beyond those words. The Baha'i perspective is that reality, in its deepest sense, goes beyond language. It doesn't mean that language is pointless, useless, or doesn't help us apprehend it and live it. But it does mean that all our complex monuments of ideas remain approximate. Truth is always bigger than our heads. We are always part of something bigger. If we were able to comprehend in our heads the entirety of existence, we would stand outside it. Comprehension means sort of surrounding, and you cannot surround something you're in the midst of. So we are constantly in the process of becoming. This was one of the great insights of existentialism, of existentialist philosophy, was this notion that all that is very well said in Molière's Candide at the end, of Molière, sort of at the end of these extraordinary experiences of cataclysms and calamities, where he had Pangloss telling him, you know, it is all for the good, it all has a purpose, and it's all going horribly, horribly wrong. And by the end of it, this ingenue arrives, you know, and sort of Pangloss tries to say something, another great philosophical concept, and he says, all that is very well, but let us cultivate our garden. In the end, we are in existence, we are in becoming, and all our sort of monuments of thought are approximations, which is why they are constantly being renewed, transformed in dialogue. No one ever has the truth, much as some people have sort of claimed or thought or sought to have it in words. Why this in relation to all these questions? Well, because in the end, the whole concept of God is one that is laden with vocabulary, with concepts, with ideas and concepts that are common sense to our understanding of religion, and yet, in many ways, are utterly counter to the Baha'i perspective on it. And one of the more interesting aspects of it for me, because my brother will correct me whether I'm fifth or sixth generation atheist. Is it fifth or sixth? I can't remember. I think I'm fifth generation atheist. So I kind of sit, I'm on my mother's side. On my father's side, a dialectical materialist. So this notion of God was not one that kind of rolled off the tongue, as it were, for me. And it is interesting that a concept, a word amongst the wide vocabulary, the very rich, very diverse vocabulary that is found in the Baha'i writings to refer to that which others call God, and the Baha'i writings too in passing, more than in passing to be fair, but one of the terms that actually in English is often translated as God is al-haq, which means the truth or the reality, reality of truth. What Baha'is are seeking is reality. What Baha'is are exploring is truth, with a capital T, with a maximum R. That was an interesting linguistic concept, the maximum R. Go to your linguistics professor. He'll say it doesn't exist, but it does. The maximum R, it's a big R, like reality. It feels stronger, it's maximum. So what is the maximum R of reality? This is how we approach truth. Now, there is a story sort of retold in the Baha'i writings, but sort of it's an ancient story, where three different nationalities begin arguing. They have very sort of, someone is very sick, and there's three doctors from different nationalities who are all trying to heal this patient with food. And the patient is a king, so their lives are at stake, and this is a very important thing. And there is not much time to lose. So as you can imagine, the passions of these doctors are rather heated. It is not just their monthly stipend that is at risk, but their heads. So one of them says, what it is clear that the remedy for this is that he needs a grape. Says, no, of course it's not grapes. They says the Spanish one, it's uvas. And the third one says, oh my God, my French has suddenly departed from my head and left a blank. How do you say grapes in French? Raisin, merci. The third one is raisin. And of course they're so heated, the stakes are so high that they're virtually at each other's throats, disagreeing as to whether they're going to give him grapes, uvas, or raisin. Till someone eventually points to them, that's what we need, and they'll go, ah, me oui, claro que sí. And of course, it is the same thing. The Baha'i perspective on God is a bit like that. That really, this word God has been made a cause célèbre, and a point of conflict, a source of flags where people mark out their territory. This is my God, this is your God, this is no God. What the God? Mm-hmm. And for Baha'is, the question is not God. That's a secondary question. The question is truth, reality. What is true? What is real? And that is a question that begins much earlier, and it's universal. It is not predicated on a religious identity, on a tribe, on an ethnicity. It is predicated on existing, simply, and interacting with reality. So, how does truth come to us? How do we arrive at conviction? Because this is the other aspect, that there seems to be, from a Baha'i perspective, and hopefully from a fairly non-controversial perspective, a distance between reality and the models that we make of it as we go along. And our vision of what the world is like when we're 5 is different from when we're 8, from when we're 15, from when we're 50, and from when we die. And at all these stages, there is a rational being making the best of what confronts it, with the materials it has acquired. And the process by which it acquires convictions, some of which may prove closer or more distant from reality, is a process not just of personal discovery and testing and experimentation, but I think, and this is something that is frequently lost sight of, it is quintessentially, in my view, a journey of trust. When we negotiate reality, we are, I think, less negotiating concepts than lines of trust. I think most of the facts about the universe that we carry have not been discovered by ourselves, personally. I didn't really personally work out the laws of gravity. And if pushed, I couldn't really prove them to you. But I kind of take them for granted. Now, there are very few, if any, people alive except those born contrarians who still hold that the Earth is flat, or that the Earth does not revolve around the Sun, but vice versa. Most people are agreeing that that is not the case. I would suggest that most people have not verified it themselves. We've just taken it on trust. It is part of our education. We know that someone back then discovered it, and they knew what they were doing. And how do we know that they knew what they were doing? Because somebody who we think knows what they're doing told us. And how do we know that they kind of were in a position to, you know, because we kind of trust that all the people who knew what they were doing, who told them, and eventually filtered to our school teacher, who probably had as little clue about it as I do, nevertheless convinced us. And like that, with a huge amount of things, if you pause and make the exercise of thinking how many things that you are absolutely certain about, you have actually personally verified. And by verified, I mean, just think how many centuries it took to work that one out. How many experiments, how many calculations. What is the monument of science that lies behind simply saying that the Earth revolves around the Sun? And if you extend that to your entire worldview, your day-to-day existence, you realize that actually probably 90% of your intellectual life is an act of trust. It's an act of trust, in acts of trust by others, down a whole chain of thought. And that is in dialogue with your own experiments, your own personal experiential going through life. No matter if all of science told you suddenly, and you grew up knowing from all the people that you trust that there is no gravity, the moment that you walked off a first floor, you would question all the lines of trust with a rather less sightly nose. So there is a dialogue. It is not blind trust. It is a trust that is in constant negotiation. And there is a book by Wittgenstein called Uncertainty. It is a posthumous book, and he's one of the craziest of philosophers. He wrote, first of all, the book on logical positivism, the absolute foundational book. Nobody has stopped it. And he said, this proves that everything is settled, absolute, sort of to simplify matters greatly. And then he changed his mind and wrote the book on modern relativist skepticism, if you want to put it. And both books are still being used by both exponents of both schools. And when he died, he wrote, sort of somebody published eventually this book on certainty. You can look it up in university library here. It's a small thing, and it's just like aphorisms. It's not a systematic treatise. But one of the very interesting things he says is that certainty is a bit like a river where you have things that are sedimented and things that are sort of soft flowing, and that these are not static, that sometimes things that are very hardened in your mind become loosened, and things that are loosened become hardened. And that is the way we need to function. You cannot question constantly everything. You can't question whether there's going to be a floor in your next step. Though philosophically you can, and people do. But you don't, you just don't. You just don't. It's just such a waste of time. Really, don't try it. I don't recommend it. I tried it, and I got nowhere. The floor was still there. So where am I going with all this, apart from on a massive tangent? Well, I think this is where the Baha'i approach to belief is distinctive in my view. I think we are used to associating the faith in God with, I don't know, an element of will on the one hand. There is the famous saying of Tertullian, I believe because it is impossible. he never said it, but it, nevertheless, the fact that it became attributed to him and sort of survived so long shows how deeply rooted that whole psychology was. Faith as an act of will. Then you have I won't go into all the types of sort of that type of faith. Let's look at what is the Baha'i perspective on this. The Baha'i perspective is that reality, al-haq, truth, manifests itself universally, constantly, in everything. It manifests itself in this chair, in each other, in the world, even in me. It's extraordinary, but it's true. It is found everywhere. I know you wish this wasn't real, but it is. It is happening to you. I am here. The real is everywhere, and we encounter it progressively. And as I was saying, we kind of experience it in different ways. Not just the true, but the beautiful. This is another interesting thing, that it's not always an intellectual journey, although beauty is also an intellectual concept, I suppose. But it's not always necessarily a rationalistic concept, let's say. Reality is also beauty. Reality is also beautiful, and beauty is likewise found most places. I wouldn't flatter myself, but everywhere else, let's say. That beauty is here. And we encounter and experience beauty and truth and reality in the whole world. However, please don't queue up to point it out. Not everyone is equally beautiful, right? Yes, I know. Not everything is equally real, equally true. Not everything is equally abundant or equally compelling. Not everything is equally noble. So there are gradations of reality. Not in its essence, because obviously if reality is real, it's not more or less real, it just is real. But in its expression and our apprehension of it. And so we find that reality manifests itself. Another very revolutionary concept, in my view, in the Baha'i perspective on truth, is that reality is not a static entity that you bump into. But it's process. It is process. It is manifestation. It is expansion. It is infinity. Infinity as a concept is not a static concept. Infinity continues infinitely. It never ends. It is endless. Reality is infinite. Beauty is infinite. It is something that is continually extending, as it were. And even that is just a very poor description, because infinity doesn't extend. It is infinity. So, in that respect, then this reality, which in its essence is simple and beyond simplicity, in a Baha'i perspective, beyond description, beyond comprehension, nevertheless, in time, in this world in which we are, manifests itself in increasing degrees of complexity. This is a view into sort of the funkier areas of biology and physics. We'll have heard of complexity theory and how complexity exists in the boundary between chaos and order. Too much order and you don't have emergence. You don't have complexity, too much chaos and you don't have it. But in that point in between chaos and order, you have emergence, this process of increasing complexity. And we see it in the nature. You can begin by saying reality is just that energy. Energy cannot be destroyed or created, it can only be transformed. But look at this. What is this world full of richness and diversity? You have minerals, and then those minerals sort of mingle in weird ways. Again, I take it on trust, I don't actually know this myself. But I hear that minerals mingle in strange ways and create sort of living organisms. I trust that it's true. And sort of I hear that these living organisms create in and interact in weird ways and manifest emerging properties of sort of animals. And eventually you reach the level of consciousness, of human consciousness. And maybe we'll flatter ourselves that it's the apex. But it's our apex, certainly. It's the apex of what we can comprehend. This element, because it contains all other aspects of complexity and adds this extra layer of abstraction, of self, of reflexivity, being able to reflect upon ourselves as well, having this very conversation. So from a Baha'i perspective then, truth is found in everything. And it is found with increasing richness. And from an anthropocentric perspective, from the perspective of us, with increasing relevance perhaps, the further up the chain of complexity you go. And this Baha'u'llah describes as the universal emanation of reality. This is in his book of Surgery, in case you want to explore it further, but this notion that basically reality manifests itself abundantly through everything. Now, Baha'u'llah goes a step further and says, out of all of this creation, the fullest or most complex expression or the richest expression of being, in a sense, is the human. Because, as I mentioned, it contains the previous degrees of complexity and adds those layers. Now, reality does not manifest itself with equal richness in every human being. It doesn't mean it is not present latently in every human being with equal richness. We are all equally real. But we do not necessarily actualize the potentialities latent within our being in equal measure. And so we find that some human beings inspire us. Some human beings repel us. Some human beings educate us. Some human beings stifle us. And one of the great capacities we develop or fail to develop increasingly as we mature, and one of the hallmarks of maturity, is our increasing ability to discern in fellow human beings that which resonates with our truer instincts, our truer nature, that which makes us progress, and that which doesn't. So, if we refine our thoughts, we might resonate more easily with a Gandhi than with a Hitler, for example. Both human beings, both manifesting reality, but in different measures. And here we're already subjectifying reality, anthropomorphizing it. I'm aware of this. But remember that the sort of the axiom on which all this follows is that reality goes beyond language. So all our language is approximate. So these notions is what we understand of reality. And therefore Baha'u'llah brings this fundamental and in religious history, at least scripturally new, the notion that religious truth and truth generally is relative. Not relative in itself, in the sense that there is no such thing as truth or reality, but relative in relation to our cognition, relative in relation to our apprehension. Our apprehension of truth is always progressive. It is never static and complete. Therefore, we evolve our processes of trust. We learn to listen to our teachers. And we learn as we mature not to always listen to our teachers. We learn to listen to our parents, and we learn as we mature not to always listen to our parents. We learn to listen to our professors. We learn not to always listen to our professors. And in this dialogue, we revise constantly our mind maps and our panoramas, and we actually arrive at worlds, our whole realities, that are constantly evolving and constantly changing. We position ourselves constantly along a spectrum of spiritual search in which we all are involved, consciously or unconsciously. Baha'u'llah said, some know us and bear witness, while the majority bear witness, yet know us not. We bear witness to reality, all of us, but not always, in a conscious fashion. And this is where we begin to arrive at the notion of God. Baha'is, and this is my blasphemic side coming out, I suggest, conceptually, intellectually atheists. I know this is not the popular sort of perception, but hey, I stand by it. Because for Baha'is, Baha'is subscribe to what in theology is called apophatic theology. a radical apophatic theology. Apophatic means negative, means you cannot know it. You cannot comprehend it. Baha'i subscribe to the belief that reality is transcendent. In other words, it is bigger than ourselves because it contains ourselves, it includes ourselves, and goes beyond ourselves. We are part of reality, we are real, but reality is much more than we are as individuals. Therefore, anything that we claim about absolute reality, reality with its maximal R, reality in its absoluteness, anything that we claim is categorically irrelevant. Any God that we can describe is not a God that Baha'is can believe in. Because if God equals reality, and reality is ineffable and transcendent, then all language becomes lame and blind and mute and deaf. Therefore, someone once said to Abdu'l-Bahá that they were talking about idolaters who sort of worship stones. And he answered, well, in one sense, or in every sense, but in one sense, the idolater is closer to the truth of the matter than the theist. Because at least the idolater is worshipping something that is real. Whereas the theist is worshipping the idol of his own imaginations and exalted his reality above our intellectual conception. So, that door being shut, what am I doing here? No, why is there all of this? Well, because the process of interaction with reality, as I mentioned, is not just a question of discovery individually, but also relationally. It's a question of discovery through trust. And so, we realize that a whole bunch of things we take for granted because somebody we trust has told us so. We've also established that that trust is not irrational. That is, it's not uncritical, it's important to say. And this is another thing that to me is very radical and novel about the Baha'i concept of investigation and reality, is that our relationship to reality has to be critical, self-critical. We have to criticize our own perspectives, undermine our own comfort with our own ideas, and critical of voices outside. We have to sort of question all inherited conceptions. But it's not uber critical. It is not excessively critical. It is also sympathetic. We interact with reality in a sympathetic way. We seek connectedness. Connectedness with truth and connectedness with one another. So we're not constantly saying, oh yeah, prove it, about everything, because then we don't move. So the key question then becomes authority. What is the authority? What authority has anyone to tell us what to think? Most of you are coming to one of the country's best universities, one of the world's best universities, to be given information, to be essentially told what to think by very clever people. Who are they to tell you what to think? And what a waste of education it would be if you spend your entire lecture saying, oh, you have to do it. The real, you arrive at this stage by questioning the premises by which that person teaches you. And you do so on the authority, not of their say-so, but of your consent, of your persuasion. The moment that you withhold that consent, their authority over you ceases. the authority over your mind, over your consciousness. So the sovereignty of your own independent judgment becomes paramount. And this is another revolutionary concept in Baha'i scriptures, is the sovereignty of the individual's consciousness. If you do not believe the truth of Baha'u'llah's claims, his prescriptions are not binding on you. Because the authority of all those laws and concepts and instructions is solely the persuasion of your own heart. And the moment that persuasion ceases, not only are you free to leave, but you would violate the integrity of your own Baha'i belief by remaining. Because then it would be simply blind imitation and not conviction. So, as we explore this then, we find that really the word used in the Baha'i teachings for the cognition or the epistemological relationship with reality or God is not belief. Belief is used in other contexts, but very rarely in that one. The word that is used is irfan, which is translated in different ways. It is translated as recognition, knowledge, true understanding. We do not believe in God, in reality, in truth. We recognize it, or we don't. We know it, or we don't. We understand it, or we don't. We do not believe in it in that sense. Belief is the fruit of recognition. If I recognize you on the street, I believe you are who I think you are. But if I don't recognize you on the street and you tell me you're my mother, I'm sorry. You don't, you know, I won't believe you. However, if I were to recognize you as my mother, hey, you look like my mother. You know, nobody out here would believe that you're my mother, but I would. That's how sovereign my recognition is. So, the process by which then one arrives at this notion of what, because in the end, so okay, we come to this paradox. All these ineffable realities, and yet hundreds of volumes written about it. It's the same with the mystics. The mystics, I did a study sort of comparing sort of medieval mystics, and they all had many things in common. And one of the things that they all absolutely said is, no one can describe my experience before proceeding to write a book on it. And not only that, they cited each other. This description, this experience is indescribable, but as that person said, you know, he had it right when he said. So, it is an interesting dynamic here. And if reality is unknowable, why do we say, oh God? Why all these concepts? And it is interesting that at the beginning of a book called The Gleanings from the Writings of Baha'u'llah, after this meditation on the incognoscibility of God, Baha'u'llah writes that the purpose behind all these attributes that we attribute to God in the Baha'i writings, thou art the most merciful, kind, all this, is not to describe God, but to facilitate a greater knowledge of our own selves. This is mysterious and merits pondering. And I don't think we have time to delve into this. And this is an area that I will open, how this whole language is another challenge. And it's not one that I can deal with today, this, unless it comes up in questions, but this whole notion of how we relate as Baha'is, this language of interaction with this claim of unknowability. But where I want to concentrate then and conclude is that that in the end, really, what it boils down to, and not necessarily, and even I don't think most Baha'is boil it down to this, but I do think this is what it boils down to at the end for all of us, is that we do not really believe in God, in all of this. This is a second order thing. We believe, actually, or rather we recognize something that we all have access to, that has nothing to do with divine faith in that sense. We live in a man who lived in the 19th century, who was born in a country, who was put in chains, who suffered great things, who wrote great books, who achieved immense victories, and left a legacy, which is accessible absolutely to everyone, the believer, the unbeliever, the Martian, and everyone. Yes, I believe there are Martians. You know, I take it on trust. A good friend told me about it. Also fairies, actually. And, you know, I disagree with my daughter. I think Santa Claus is out there. I've just been a very naughty boy for many years. So, you know, there is this... this is a universally accessible fact. It's a human... It is no different from sort of interacting with Newton or with interacting with Joseph Conrad or Picasso. We are interacting with reality as manifested universally in the world, in human beings. Now what happens is that, as I say, most of us didn't have the pleasure of meeting Einstein, for example. In fact, I rather dare say that none of us had that pleasure. Unless it be in a spiritualist church where he sometimes visits, I understand. But basically, in the physical body, I don't think any of us have had that pleasure. But we know he exists. How do we know? Okay, actually, I never really have investigated the things earlier. I haven't been an archival researcher. But I kind of take it for granted that it's true. That these letters, that all these writings are true, that these insights, that this community of discourse that he fostered is real. And we believe in the lines of authority that are given by his research and by his persuasion of people that we trust in order to believe things that are actually quite unbelievable when you think about it. The notion that time is different for you and for me according to different, that I will age at different times if I travel faster than you do. That's not believable, come on. You know, it's like not even sort of, I don't know, H.G. Wells thought of that one, you know. It's like, okay, let's run, and I'll run faster, and you'll die younger, kind of thing. It's like, it, you know. And nevertheless, and not only that, it's the most amazing thing is that we believed this before we could prove it. We believed this because it made sense mathematically. And it wasn't until years later that we had the technology to send an atomic clock on a sort of spaceship and keep one on Earth and found that when they arrived, they had moved. They didn't have the same time. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. You know? And the astronauts did not fiddle with them. Genuinely. And not only that, but that the time difference was exactly correlative with the calculations that Einstein had worked out. Weird. We believe that. We take that on faith. Not in blind faith. Relational faith. We actually don't take it on faith. We take it on trust. It's a very different word. It's a very different nuance. We take it on trust. Now, as we confront the phenomenon of a man in the 19th century claiming to deliver a message revealing reality in a transcendent manner, we are confronting something unbelievable. Probably more unbelievable to us in the 21st century than the notion that we could age differently if we walk at different speeds. Because, particularly our generation, we are the very first generation without collective dreams. All the previous generations had dreams, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Whether it be communism or fascism or Woodstock and flower power. The big motions of youth, big masses got together towards movement. The thing that brings us together is no to globalization, no to. These are the only things that gel us in a long way, in a sustained way, collectively. Or we can come together on positive things for very short periods of time with very specific things. Yes, free Bruno the yellow gorilla. We all come together. And then we go. Usually with a gorilla in the same place at the end of it. But, you know, that is what brings us together. So, and it's not because we're apathetic. I don't buy that. Actually, it's because we're more discerning. It's because we've become burned, because we've seen where these collective dreams have led, which is not very far. And the great exponents of Woodstock are now sort of on mortgages and driving their cars and telling us, don't do what I do, or did what I say, kind of thing. So it is from discernment. So the idea of trusting again in a human being with not our cold facts of history or science, but with our motivations and our hopes, that is a no-go area. With supernatural claims, with the damage, the misuse, that is something that we do not want to touch. We not dare even conceive the possibility of trust. It reminds me of so many friends of mine who don't want to marry in case they end up divorced. So it's like, that's it, you've done it already, kind of thing. I am a rock, I am an island, and the rock feels no pain, and an island never cries. That's Simon and Garfunkel, yes, believe it or not. So we're in that place. I've got my books and my poetry to protect me. It's like, leave me alone. All that is very well, but let us cultivate our garden. That's what we've arrived. Now, in this context, then the phenomenon of a human being, because in the end that is the objective fact we all share, just like you and me, is claiming something that he shouldn't claim, that nobody should claim, that is unbelievable. That is not only unbelievable, but tricky and dangerous if we were to judge from history. And therefore, I think statistically, 90% of the population has so far, the percentage is diminishing, but still remains, I think, overwhelming, judge that it's not even worth finding out or exploring that question. And that is what I mean, where we can, when I say that we can control, we cannot control our experience of truth, but we can influence it. So by already closing down the question, the very question mark of the possibility of trust in such a outlandish and ridiculous claim, we have influenced our interaction with reality and foreclosed any possibility of that being true, whether it's true or not. However, by interacting with that claim, we are opening ourselves to the unexpected. And surely it would be unexpected. And how do we engage with this? We engage with this in the same way as we engage with everything else. We build trust, or fail to do so. And this, to me, is the essence of being and becoming a Baha'i throughout one's life. I don't think anyone ever gets there or stops getting there. There is no label, as it were. It's not a congregation you join. It's a question you ask yourself every day. What is this about? And does it persuade me? If it doesn't, I don't move. And if it does, I have then a subsequent choice. Do I move or don't I? But the first question is that one. And I think what I'd like to conclude then is by suggesting that the notion of the belief that we have about all these things that are unbelievable or supernatural are based on things that are natural and believable. In other words, I'll tell you, for example, my own personal experience of this, and I think it probably will echo those of others, is that as I interacted with the teachings and the history and all of this of Baha'u'llah, there were areas of commonality, areas that affirmed what I already saw, areas of indifference and areas of conflict that contradicted the views that I already held. The process of interaction with this continues. There are still areas of ideas and thoughts where I cannot necessarily see eye to eye with the Baha'i writings. That doesn't mean I challenge or deny them. It just means it's not my worldview hasn't harmonized fully there. There are other areas where it does, and areas where it is all a big all, or even a big whatever, you know? And the process, therefore, of interaction with this is by using the touchstone of one's own convictions. And yet, if that's all we use, we will never move beyond them. Because if the claim of this is truly transcendent, if the claim that Baha'u'llah is making is that the reality he's presenting to us is transcendent, there has to be conflict. There has to be tension. Because if there was no tension, we would already comprehend it. If we agreed with everything, it would have nothing new to teach us. So then the real question becomes to establish, what will persuade me individually that I can trust enough in the authenticity of this message and its truth to be able to take on trust the things that I don't currently understand or accept. When that trust becomes strong enough, we are able to absorb an element of cognitive dissonance. Just like at the moment, physicists absorb cognitive dissonance between quantum mechanics and relativity, because they have to. But there's enough of truth in both of them that it allows them to persevere and to commit and to invest in every way in it. In the same way, I think the process of being a Baha'i is one of increasing commitment and investment to a relationship of trust in a voice that persuades one's mind and one's heart, not just with truth as reason, but with truth as beauty, because beauty attracts and enamors. And the combination of love and conviction is what generates motion and cohesion. And that, I think, is a vision and the offer of the Baha'i community. A common journey towards vision and cohesion, above and beyond the boundaries of belief and of identity. And with that, I finish today. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Velasco, for that discourse and wonderfully presented.
I should come more often. Nobody calls me Mr. Velasco. Really, I feel so excited. Thank you so much, Mr. Wilf, for calling me Mr. Velasco.
You're welcome. And I guess with that, the floor is open to any questions or comments.
No tomatoes, please. I think it is a bit like the difference between surviving and living, in a sense. To survive, you need only a certain amount of food. But to enjoy yourself, you need a better dish, kind of thing. I think, to me, one of the things is that my feeling is that truth is process, as I say. You never kind of get it. If you do not make the process of your interaction with reality a conscious one, you will absorb it unconsciously, which means that you can become prey to manipulation, to self-defeating and dysfunctional beliefs. We do that all the time. In fact, I think most of our, as I say, I think we have a very strong force of inertia. A lot of our identity is just inherited, and a lot of what we inherit isn't very good. So you're likely not to interact with people who are very different from you. Or if someone flatters your prejudices, you're likely to follow them. Unless you are taking ownership over your own interaction with reality. So I think in that respect, my feeling is that the best reason to search for truth, for reality, is to avoid living in fiction when fiction might not be helpful to you or to others. what do you think? Do you think that sort of it is enough to kind of, do you think there is a point where you just feel, okay, I got it, come back to me later? Or do you think that there is a value in that questioning, in asking yourself, what is it all about?
I'm just not sure what the difference between, he said that you come and treachery, it's like a bullying entity, it comes where it doesn't come. And in a way, rationality is a nice thing, but you either think that something's true or you don't.
Right.
So if people manipulate you or you believe that Einstein existed, whereas let's say it's a hoax. Then how can you trust yourself that you instinctively recognize the truth?
That's a wonderful point. And it's wonderful also because people often become intolerant when they think they've got the truth. I take a very humble view about it, and I think that you just cannot be sure. And that's why you should keep asking. In other words, that we do the best we can. So you act according to the truth that you're persuaded by. But you keep them in question marks. Because as you say, how do I know that what I know is true? And this is where it becomes a matter of trust. I don't know it, but I'm going to trust it for now until I find something that works better for me, in a sense. So I think that's a really, really good question. I'd be surprised if anyone could answer, I know this is true, because it's true and that's it. I mean, people do, but that doesn't persuade me. I share your uncertainty. And I think it's a sign of maturity to be comfortable with uncertainty. Have a balance. Not to seek to stop uncertainty all the time. Either by bullying it into being something, or by just giving up, asking yourself what it's all about. I think a kind of middle ground might be best.
But if you have to question your beliefs, so to say, all the time, an intellectual exercise and something that makes you happy, then how can you trust a human being? Why wouldn't you reconsider your trust to everyone around you all the time? What's the difference between questioning, reconsidering your belief in trusting a human being and trusting an idea?
I suppose maybe it's not so much as what I mentioned, that sort of, although we have a critical vision, Mahala warns up against excessive criticism. No? And he has a very good phrase, a very positive phrase. It's, the essence of all that we have revealed is justice. It is for man to look into all things with an inquiring eye, or with a seeking gaze, as it were. So I suppose the idea is not so much to question for the sake of questioning as an intellectual exercise, but to strive for fairness, for justice in your judgments. No? Is my position on this fair? Is my understanding of this fair? Because that kind of justice will probably sort of make your life better. Whereas sort of questioning for questioning's sake, or not question, again, that kind of middle ground. So I would say more, not so much a constant self-questioning, but more looking into things with an inquiring mind and being fair in one's judgments. It sounds easy, but I think it's something that requires mindfulness. No? And I think maybe that's what it's about, just being mindful, or rather than obsessive, mindful of what it is that we believe and what we trust and who we trust in. And it is good to trust. I think actually I personally prefer to opt for trust rather than mistrust. I find it makes me happier. It makes my world a bit more sort of bright. Thank you.
Even if you belong to a certain scientific paradigm and you try to prove or disprove a theory, if you're questioning things, you still commit to the laws of that paradigm in order to conduct your experiments.
Right.
And only through that commitment you then come to a set of experimental methodology or whatever, and then that leads to your results, which gives you a new set of knowledge or a new understanding. And so I've been thinking about things, so how does that relate then to a spiritual paradigm or an investigation of religion or faith or whatever? Because yes, there is a question of your search after truth, and we encourage us perhaps to independently search truth, but ultimately you also search by commitment. And it is only by committing to the set of precepts and laws that you can actually then experience and perhaps reach certainty, not a state of faith. So I was just wondering your comments on that, and is that relevant? So at what point do we start questioning and also just commit? And then is it just a cyclical thing? We commit, so we question, so that we commit, and then once we reach the level of understanding through that commitment, we then question again and then commit.
That is beautiful. That's a beautiful point, very evocative. I suppose my feeling is that we tend to compartmentalize our experience, maybe excessively, into sort of the intellectual, the aesthetic, the etc. This is why, for me, the emphasis is not so much on concepts as on relationships. I think when we understand that this is a relationship that you build with a thinker, in this case, and with a community, if you go further, then you apply the whole notion of relationships to it, and it changes your interaction with it. Because in a relationship, you do analysis is an important part, but it is not as important a part as interaction and trust and commitment. And so I think also, just even intellectually, as you say, I thought that was a very illuminating example, this notion that you learn paradigms by exploring them in a committed fashion. And it is very different to sort of describe the sea, you know, on the outside without a scientific book and diving into it. And I think this is why I didn't get a chance to discuss it too much today, but the notion of beauty is such an important part of it for me as well. That it is a mix of this dynamic between beauty and truth. That and beauty stimulates commitment. Now, it is not an artificial thing. There is an element of will, but the will is triggered by love, and love is triggered by beauty. You come across these teachings and say, "What beautiful teachings!" And that makes you want to read more. That is a commitment. You've committed your time. You have limited time and infinite amounts of books, and you've committed to reading this one. Why? Because those teachings seemed beautiful. Or the people you met, say that the Baha'is, or maybe what you heard about the Baha'i community and what it's doing or represents, etc. Or all together, the life, Baha'u'llah, the words, many things. Without that element of beauty, then I think it's hard to energize commitment. And that's one of the things that I think most non-scientists, including myself, don't really understand, is how scientists and mathematicians in particular speak of beauty, of a beautiful equation. You know, and sometimes, you know, and they use that as a criterion for deciding on it. They say, you know, "I believe this is true because it is beautiful." You're a mathematician! You know, like slap, slap, slap. You know, that's not how it works. But it's an interesting thing. So beauty to me is the missing element in that, in a sense. That if you don't experience beauty, then it becomes just a cold concept. One more idea, which it doesn't mean it's not useful, it becomes one more thinker. But I don't think that element of exploration kicks in a genuine way until you develop a sense of beauty. And it's that beauty that overcomes the unbelievability of it all, in a sense. Is that what and it's the same in a relationship with a lover. You only get so far, and there is no moment where commitment does not entail risk. And the bigger the risk, the more meaningful the commitment. And this is why sometimes people think that by going through lots and lots of partners, they will actually be better and better prepared for a lifelong relationship, whereas actually, it's by taking more and more risks of commitment and trust and surviving them, that you go, wow, let's invest in this more. So in a sense, that's how I relate to that. Thank you for that. That's really beautiful.
Look, you go.
Well, you spoke a lot about beauty in the Baha'i faith, and I was just wondering, where did you see the beauty? Like, when you first encountered it, how do you define that? Or
I suppose
it's like saying an equation is beautiful, but...
Well, in a sense, it's more to me like saying, you know, if you're in love with someone, sort of, what was the beauty of it, kind of thing, of that person? It's such a personal thing. I mean, there was an intellectual beauty of it that was probably what first struck me. I found a great deal of coherence, which I hadn't found. In going to maths then, maybe this coherence. I grew up with these two big drives in my aspirations and my upbringing. One was this search for truth. You know, I grew up, as I say, in a sort of Marxist, but not theoretical Marxist, in a guerrilla environment where people lived their commitment and were willing to die for it, asking, sort of learning, being trained to question common sense approaches. You know, when I was 5, my grandfather told me that I was sitting on his lap and it started raining. And someone said, how can they say there is no God? And I took my thumb out of my mouth because I sucked it until I was 6 or so. And said, well, the water evaporates, it makes a cloud, it condenses, and it rains there. No God. And that's the kind of education that I've received, in a sense. This kind of what is real question, what is real? And the other one was justice, social justice. How can you sort of live in peace when around you people are suffering? It's, you cannot settle. How can you close your eyes? This is, their pain is your pain, and it's, you know, unbearable. So, what I found as I grew up was that platforms, thoughts, groups that were very strong in the social justice aspect did not really persuade my sense of deeper truth. And groups and beliefs that persuaded my sense of truth in deep ways did not meet my expectations of relevance, of social relevance. So the great spiritual groups and philosophers seemed to me just so out of touch with the needs of the world today. And at the same time, all those great activists seemed to me to be missing these entire realms of experience. And I suppose one of the first things that I found beautiful in the Baha'i Faith was the coherence that I found in these two things, that I somehow did not have to choose between my head and my heart, in a sense. There was a, you know, the notion that the philosophy, the conceptions were cogent, were compelling, were logical. And the spirit was noble and positive and encouraging. The Baha'is impressed me, the diversity that I experienced, and the good intentions, because I didn't see them as particularly more advanced than other groups of people that I had seen. But I did see a really almost universal commitment to try really hard for aims and goals that were very noble and more cogently expressed than anything I had seen. And finally, I think what touched me was a more, I don't know if I'd call it mystical, but a kind of an experience of the figure of Baha'u'llah, sort of what, putting it all together, the achievements, the vision, the word, the integrity of that life, the sheer bravery of making those claims, and somehow sustaining them with such coherence and beauty, all that were elements of it for me.
I really share your view that the reality is beyond of language, of words, and that through recognition we understand the beauty of this reality. Is that You mentioned it is a Baha'i perspective. When I see, when I read the Buddha's teachings, I find the heart of the Buddha's teachings is the reality is beyond language. We are aware of this. Also, when I read the teachings of Jesus, it's in terms of the reality is beyond words and through recognition. Also, the heart of Islam message. And believing in the truth is a pathless land in which there is no view, there is no perspective, because reality, it was not written in the Upanishads, for instance, 4,000 years ago, saying this, or in the 19th century, but it's something beyond time. That therefore it makes no perspective, no view. It is everywhere.
That is so beautiful, and I believe that that is the, a subject that I've been invited to sort of treat in detail at sort of the next session. I don't know when that's organized for. But that doesn't mean, you know, I'm copying out. But I think there is one of the points I made is that the vision of the Baha'i faith, the vision of identity, is not tribal. So it is not about, let's choose between them, and of course, we Baha'is, we've got it, kind of thing. No. The opposite. If truth is, as you say, universal, and this is the quintessential message of all religion, really, of all religions, this notion that reality is transcendent, I think there is another element to all those teachings, which is the challenge that, because in a sense, if that was it, they wouldn't write anything. They wouldn't say anything, because it was there, but you know, what's the point? But there is this extra element to all those teachings, which is the perennial endeavor or attempt to somehow link that timeless transcendence to our experience of time, because we live in time. So in a sense, the great fruit, challenge, and purpose of religion at its best when it is functional, and the biggest casualty when it is dysfunctional, is precisely its capacity to harness this indescribable, ineffable awareness to social interactions adapted to that time that engender not empires but civilizations. It is a fact, I think, probably unparalleled. I don't know whether you can think of any examples, but I can't think of any examples of a whole civilization being named after an individual. You know, Christian civilization, Buddhist civilization, outside of the phenomenon of religion. Now, what that means is obviously, you know, a very debatable thing, but this influence somehow of these individuals is unparalleled, and it's happened maybe 8 or 9 or 10 times in history, recorded history at least, maybe less. And so, the question then that Baha'u'llah asks, in a sense, is if we accept that there is such a thing as transcendent, as a reality that is transcendent, if we accept that it is nonetheless manifested throughout the universe, and it is manifested in approximate but in increasing ways, not all patterns of order and chaos manifest equal amounts of success or complexity, then the question is, what are the instruments, the relationships we need to establish? What are the practices that we can foster that will facilitate, at this point in time, our access and harnessing of that reality? And that's where the Baha'i notion of progressive revelation comes in. The notion that religion actually is one. All religions have this just fundamental sort of message. They all teach exactly the same things in their essence. And a good Christian, a good Baha'i, a good Muslim, and even a good humanist will behave pretty much the same way. What changes is how you apply those fundamental principles, truthfulness, justice, etc., to different contexts. What justice meant in 8th century Arabia is very different to what social justice might mean in 21st century world. So that those truths then require a restatement. That's the Baha'i vision anyway. And the claim of Baha'u'llah is that he is restating the fundamental, perennial, changeless truths of every faith and every sort of enlightened thinker in a social teaching adapted to this time. And Baha'is reject finality. They think that this is an ongoing, natural, constant evolutionary process that will be repeated in the future. So that when we've outgrown this current paradigm, we'll be in need of another one. And all these concepts we are using, a good many of them will seem less relevant than they will later. I don't know whether that in any way...
I see the message in Eurovision.
Uh-huh.
There must be one religion, and everybody united. Also, this is, you find this message in each religion. But I personally see...
Sorry, just to cut in there, just the difference, the Baha'is don't say there has to be like one religion, and you choose.
Yes.
But that there already is.
Yeah.
It's the reality of reality, in a sense. And the different congregations we create are purely temporal side effects, as it were, of the time. And I don't think that's something that is said generally, because actually I think traditionally, at least congregations have used their religious identity as a way of distancing themselves from diverse beliefs. So I don't know whether that's what you meant or not. But
well, I'm talking about the heart of the religion.
Okay.
And you are obviously, you have on the top of the institutions, the different interpretations.
Mm.
I personally see the beauty of to see throughout history different, let's say, prophets or different masters, that they have touched the hearts of different people, different cultures. And this is the beauty of the diversity.
Mm.
And I know people that they were fascinated by the life of Abuana.
Sorry, just a second.
We're just
going to
have a little chat ourselves.
Ah, fine, just outside, okay. It's just I didn't want to lose you.
And I see the beauty of these different masters or prophets in different cultures. They have touched the heart of different people. And to push them towards this world is beyond words. So I see this diversity as a personal view necessary to keep like each culture or the choice of each person to find the truth, which is the same. But in a different place, and therefore I find beautiful to have or to see different religions, which in the end, on the bottom of that, the point was the same thing, which is introversion. So I see this just sharing with you. That this reality, I see, and this diversity, I find beautiful in the world. That there must be cultural religions with their
own. That is, if I understand you correctly, I think that is very much the Baha'i position too, and that is kind of what is fostered, not so much a respect, but a genuine reverence for all faith. And an interaction and a capacity to see that beauty with all of them. I think the question that becomes is how we respond to the distinctive claims of each. And that's where the challenge comes from. And this is, I think, again, we don't have time to go into it, but I think this is what the focus of Baha'u'llah is now, is on how do we, having accepted this commonality, how do we now reconcile the competing claims which and how do when they, and how do we relate as individuals now to those claims today? You know, that is the question. That's really wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you for all those questions, and thank you, Israel, again for coming.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
Receiving you again in the future.
10th of March.
10th of March. Okay.
Thank you.
Maybe 7th of February. Next month, 7th of March.
Great.
Polish today.
Yeah,
exactly. Great. Thank you. If there's nobody here, I know this was a success. Not. No, that's great. Thank you. Thank you, everyone. This was called singing for your supper. Now I need to go and have it.
All right.
Yeah, we can work it out.